good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and my guest today is Chris Centeno. He is a physician involved in regenerative orthopedics and has been a guest on this program before. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So the last time we talked, you were in the throes of some clinical trials, very exciting clinical trials. Why don't you talk about what's been happening?
Sure, yeah. First let me back up a little bit. We treat patients who have, for instance, knee arthritis with their own stem cells mm-hmm. to try to help avoid knee replacement, as well as other types of problems, including rotator cuff tears, etc. So on the knee arthritis front, we've now been track the results of more than 1,000 patients treated, and you know, they're doing quite well. Probably been able to, on average, help 2 out of 3 patients avoid getting a knee replacement. For instance, on the rotator cuff side, we have a much more formalized clinical trial we're involved in there, and the early results look very good in helping patients avoid the need for a rotator cuff surgery. So these are both just through injection without the need for surgery.
Okay, so for people that may have missed when we've talked about what you do, let's go through, you know, a person comes to your clinic, which is in Colorado, not in Oregon or Washington.
Right.
What happens?
Sure. So let's say you have a bad knee.
Right.
Yeah, knee arthritis problem. You've been told that you either might need a knee replacement one day or that you need one now.
Right.
We get an MRI or you get an MRI, and we look at the overall condition of the knee. We do a really thorough exam in order to look for things like whether or not the knee is stable or the ligaments might be loose. And we then plan a treatment, i.e. where we're going to put the cells. You would come in the morning, the back of the hip would get numbed up. We would take out what's called a bone marrow aspirate. So with a needle, we would take out what looks like thick blood from the back of the hip area. Mm-hmm. And we isolate the stem cells out of that sample, and then you would come back in the afternoon, and we'd place those into specific parts of the knee. And that's pretty much how that would look or work.
Okay, so now, like, comparing that with having knee surgery, then like, you have to stay at the clinic, or you just leave?
No, it's a walk-in, walk-out procedure. So there is no need for crutches. There is no need for any extensive rehabilitation related to the procedure. And there is very little downtime. So, for instance, if you had a knee replacement, obviously, most patients I talk to who get their knees replaced, you know, it takes a good 6 to 12 months before they're really back to everything they used to do. In our procedure, we'll ask you to reduce your activity for a couple of days, and then you can get back to things like, let's say, using an elliptical to work out just for cardiovascular, and we'd want you back at full activities at about 6 weeks.
So that would mean that if you had quit running because your knee was bum, you could take a stab at some running at about 8 weeks or 6 weeks?
Yeah, so that's what that would look like. And again, the much different from a big surgery recovery where you're really trying to get over the trauma of the surgery. Since these are just injection-based procedures, there really isn't a need to get over the trauma from the procedure itself.
Okay, well, what about when people say, oh, well, I have to have a knee replacement because I have bone on bone?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the more interesting things about that is the research seems to show that in some of the largest studies that have been done to date, one of them is called the Osteoarthritis Initiative, another is the Framingham cohort. Both of those really show that if we just look at pictures of people's knees, i.e. an x-ray or an MRI that shows a lot of arthritis, we're not really good at predicting who in that group hurts and who doesn't. I mean, we can't say these people over here have less cartilage, therefore they're going to hurt a lot more than these people over here who have more cartilage, therefore they're going to hurt a lot less. In fact, there isn't really that kind of association. So, you know, I think we have this in our head because it's been implanted there that if we don't have any cartilage in our knee, somehow it can't function. But we have many, many patients who have, you know, very little cartilage in one area, bone on bone, who function just fine after a stem cell treatment. So again, if you wanted to be a professional athlete, you probably wouldn't be able to do that. Or if you wanted to run a marathon, it might be very difficult. But as far as daily functioning, mm-hmm. it probably doesn't make as big a difference as we once thought it did.
Yeah, well, I always thought the notion that a person was bone on bone was probably not even accurate.
True.
There are cartilaginous cells in there, no matter what. There may not be a ton, but there are some. And I think it's often as a manipulative tool to push a person towards having surgery. You know, you paint the worst possible picture, make the person look like they're about to collapse and never get up again.
Yes, I think there's certainly some salesmanship that happens in medicine, whether it be a surgeon trying to convince a physician or a patient to go to surgery, or just, you know, a physician who wants you to take this drug, not that drug, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, okay, so you talked about that the knee trial is looking pretty phenomenal. Right? 2 out of 3 people don't need any other procedures.
Correct. Yeah, that's working well. The rotator cuff trial is looking good. We also have knee ACL that we're also doing, meaning those are younger patients who have got an ACL tear,
mm-hmm.
and who want to keep their natural ACL, because right now, if you get an ACL tear, you know, what happens is the surgeon rips out the natural parts and pieces and then installs an artificial ligament, usually at not the same angle. So these are folks who had ACL tears under precise ultrasound or x-ray guidance, replacing the stem cells into the ACL tear.
Mm-hmm.
And again, seeing very nice results, not only clinically, but on MRI, in that case, repair of the ACL tear and an ACL that looks more normal.
Mm-hmm. How many of those are there in the trial?
You know, we have done about 40 of those patients, 40, 50 of those patients to date with stem cells,
mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, again, doing really, really well, not only on clinical metrics, like I can do more, but also on pictures that seem to show that many of these ACL tears that we thought would never heal are healing.
Mm, God, that's great. Now, isn't there a hip trial going on?
Yeah, we not so much a formalized trial, but we have been tracking the hip mm-hmm. patients that we've treated. We're up now about 400 or 450 or so hip patients. These are patients with hip arthritis. Almost all of them are patients who have been told they need a hip replacement, or if they're not at that level yet, usually a labral tear. And the hip patients tend to underperform the knee patients a bit, meaning that all things being equal, while we have some very good results in treating hips, if we compared the average hip patient to the average knee patient, the average hip patient would generally lag behind the average knee patient in results.
Mm-hmm. Well, but if it's my hip and I do well, then I don't care about the,
well,
the knee
right.
patient.
Yeah, just looking at lots of people. You're right.
Right. So you said about 500 hips?
Yeah, about 450 or so. Is
uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so, like, give a percent, you know, a percent that are significantly improved.
Oh, for
Or that
for
wouldn't
hips.
Need, it wouldn't need further surgery or...
Yeah, I would say for hips, we're probably preventing the need for a replacement in about 1 in every 2. So less than mm-hmm. in the knees, mm-hmm. But still pretty good given mm-hmm. that, you know, the hip patients that don't need the hip replacement just obviously got injections versus a replacement of the hip is taking apart bone and inserting a prosthesis.
Yeah, I don't know. For my sensibilities, it makes more sense to do the least invasive procedure first, and you can always get heavy later.
Yeah.
But can you go the other way? I mean, I don't know why one would want to.
No, I think, yeah, once you pull the trigger on a replacement, that's kind of it.
Uh-huh. So you don't take people post-surgery?
We have seen them post-surgery, and it's interesting. I mean, if you just look at knee replacement, you would think, for instance, that the average pain score of a patient on 1 through 10 after a knee replacement would be a 0 or a 1, but it's actually the most common number chosen as a 5.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, so there are a lot of patients out there who have pain in that joint after it's been replaced.
Mm-hmm.
And we do see some of those patients. Now, sometimes we can help them because the pain was never really from the knee. Let's say it was coming from their back or
right.
It was coming from something else, and we can treat that something else. And then sometimes they develop a new set of issues.
Like weakness, atrophy, things like that?
Well, there's that component, but there's an awful lot of reaction these days to the prosthesis. So we'll see it.
They get some inflammation?
Yeah, so there's little wear particles that come off of these prostheses, and most patients are fine with them, but some patients who are sensitive, let's say, to metal, cobalt in particular. So these are usually
mm-hmm.
patients that have like jewelry allergies. They can't wear certain kinds of jewelry
mm-hmm.
against their skin. They'll be the ones that are more likely to react to the cobalt or other components. Chromium and cobalt are the two of the prosthesis. So as it wears off, it goes into their bloodstreams or touches the surrounding tissue, and they get a pretty healthy inflammatory reaction and quite a bit of pain from that. And in fact, I saw one about 6 months ago and asked her, you know, the question that the surgeon should ask, which is, do you have a jewelry allergy? And she said, oh yeah, I've never been able to wear certain types of jewelry. And regrettably, you know, it was a clear metal sensitivity reaction. So that's a good lesson for
right.
anyone even who's going to get a joint replaced. If you can't wear a certain kinds of jewelry, that probably needs to be talked about with the doctor.
Well, right. I could just see the nightmare of I get implanted the metal that I'm allergic to.
Yes. That's
insane. And eventually I could see, you got to take this out of me. It's making me sick.
Yeah, then that's a big problem, obviously. Taking it out is really difficult because the first surgery goes from a 60 to 90 minute surgery. The second surgery is a 4-hour surgery. Things adhere to the prosthesis. Usually if there's that situation, there's been a lot of inflammation and scarring. So really a very bad situation. So never a good, always a good idea if you're going to need that kind of surgery, obviously, to make sure that you're not allergic to any components of the prosthesis.
Can we talk about spine? It seemed to me there was some kind of a trial that was some part of the spine. Am I remembering wrong?
Yeah, we certainly treat different parts of the spine. We've looked at stem cells for a lot of different issues in the spine, everything from disc bulges pressing on the nerves to painful discs in the back.
Mm-hmm.
To degenerative discs, and you know,
good.
It's
these are all the things that pretty much people over 50 have or may have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, when it comes to bulging discs pressing on nerves,
mm-hmm.
then we eventually did. This is something we started treating about 10 years ago. Develop a way to more reliably get rid of the bulge by injecting specialized stem cells into the bulge itself.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that's actually a technology that in the U.S. is considered a drug. So in the U.S. it's currently being put through the FDA trials process because it involves culturing the cells to get bigger numbers. But in the interim, we've partnered with a clinic down in Grand Cayman where that's not considered a drug. culturing the cells, and that's something that we offer down there.
So people can go have an awesome vacation and get fixed.
They can.
I like it.
Yeah, I always tell patients, you know, it could be worse. It could be Detroit or something.
Right,
you know,
exactly, in December.
That's right. It's not a bad place to go. But and then, you know, there are patients, obviously, who have just painful discs. And, you know, that's something that the types of procedures that can be done in the U.S. Tends to work well with. Those are same-day stem cell procedures like I was talking about with the knee. And that's where the cells are taken out in the morning and then injected into the painful disc in the afternoon. And then for degenerative discs, meaning discs that are pancaked out, the disc mm-hmm. is collapsed, those actually tend to respond reasonably well. Not so much treating the disc itself, because the stem cells at this juncture don't seem to be capable of re-plumping up and regrowing the disc. But more from the standpoint of just treating some of the associated ligaments and nerves and joints that are irritated and kind of managing that condition. But right now...
So not using stem cells, or yes, using stem cells?
Not necessarily. You know, many of those patients will treat with platelets and platelet-rich plasma or lysates. So blood components to
add more nutrition and new cells to the area.
Yeah, so for a injured facet joint, for instance, we'll inject platelet-rich plasma to try to help the joint keep up with the extra forces. For irritated nerves, we'll inject the growth factors from the blood platelets, which are anti-inflammatory around those nerves, so things like that.
And then how do people do, you know, versus the more common thing, which is the big lucrative thing, which is doing surgery?
Yeah, so when it comes to, we'll go work backwards, when it comes to the degenerative disc disease patients, they're generally getting fusions, and fusions are it's just a huge surgery. And, you know, I always tell my patients and in my practice that fusions, a fusion is a dog with big fleas, meaning that, you know, I can't tell you how many patients I've seen after a low back or a neck fusion who come back shortly thereafter, 6 months to 2 years later, and the level above now is starting to go because we fuse solid the other levels, and that force has to go someplace. And so as a result of that, we'll generally manage patients with this concept of treating their ligaments, joints, and nerves, and that works very well. I'd say that probably 70-80% of those patients never move on to a fusion.
And so you're talking about giving them some platelets, right?
Correct. It would be more platelet-based treatments, only because we have not been able to get the stem cells to regrow a degenerated disc. Now, they can do things like reduce the size of a disc bulge, and in those patients, you know, that's a very successful procedure to prevent a discectomy. So a discectomy is where the surgeon would go in and slice out a piece of the disc.
Mm-hmm. And those aren't all that successful.
You know, they're not. There's a bunch of research that seems to show that they're no better, you know, patients are no better for having had that surgery about a year after the procedure. So, you know, a year out from the procedure, we have a hard time telling the folks that had that surgery versus the folks that didn't.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's another risk and all the associated downtime and atrophy. And expense, the huge expense.
Yeah, they're very expensive procedures. They're also very risky procedures. So with fusion, you know, as an example, you know, the fusion complication rates are really high, and the complications can be horrible. There was actually a colleague physician in the Metro Denver area, and this was when I just started practice 20 years ago, who underwent a fusion procedure and woke up blind, because of the blood loss. And, And as far as I know, never got his sight back. And obviously, for a physician, that meant that he had to retire. So these are big procedures that can have very big, serious side effects. And you know, again, I always tell my patients, big procedures, big complications, little procedures, little complications.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, one of my colleagues had neck surgery and came out paralyzed in, you know, from the arm down.
That's, yeah, I mean, it happens. And I think, you know, we all kind of believe it's not going to happen to us.
Right.
And it usually doesn't happen to us.
Right. But if it does, then you lose.
Yeah, true. If
and
you're
if
the one.
Right. But if there's something that you could do that would be low risk and high potential of being beneficial, that seems like where we ought to go. And yet what stops people is that insurance doesn't pay. I mean, we have that barrier. People do what their insurance will pay for.
It's true, and I think that's a big problem, is that regrettably, much of our medical care system is designed around what insurance companies will and won't pay for. The problem is that generally what they will and won't pay for, that list isn't they'll pay for all the good stuff and not pay for all the bad stuff. In fact, frequently, it's the opposite.
So who makes the list?
Yeah, well, that's a whole other set of issues. I think that the list is generally made by the vested interest in medicine, you know, just like anything else. I mean, obviously those vested interests find their way into government. They find their way into medicine and medical guidelines as well.
So we're not talking about patient-centered care.
No, and in fact, I think we're talking about insurance-centered care, meaning, you know, here's a great example. So recently, there's a physician discussion group I'm on, 3,000 physicians, all of whom have some interest in regenerative-type orthopedics. Most of them don't do it, but have an interest. Some might do some platelet-rich plasma. Some other ones might do some stem cells. And there's been a lot of good research that shows that the anesthetic Marcaine or bupivacaine, a long-acting anesthetic, is really nasty stuff. Not only does it kill cartilage cells in a joint, but it also kills stem cells and other types of cells.
Where is that used?
So it turns out it's probably the most common anesthetic used today in joint injections.
Oh, great.
And so...
Oh, God.
In asking all these colleagues, why are we still using this stuff? Here's yet another paper that shows it's really nasty and it's killing cartilage cells. Why are we injecting this into joints? And the answer kind of came back after you sifted through all the responses, is that it's covered by insurance. And it can provide some temporary relief. So it is that mindset that regrettably determines what we oftentimes get, not what's the absolute best thing I can do for that patient in this situation, but what their carrier will cover.
So I know we've talked about this before. So what is how do we push the rock up so that it gets over to the top of the hill and we can actually have everyone have access to this? I mean, we only have a bubble of aging people that I'm in that group. I want to be able to have this when I need it, and I want to have Medicare pay for it. And I think Medicare should be paying for it.
Yeah, I think it's coming. I think that there's so much research being done on this kind of care that we will see coverage happen. Regrettably, though, you know, that can be a long haul to get coverage for everything. So I'll give you a concrete example. The lubricating shots, Synvisc and other types of lubricating shots for the knee, first got FDA approval in 1997 and insurance coverage soon after. Now, since then, we've had all sorts of great research, works in the shoulder and other major joints, and it would make sense. If it's going to work in the knee, it'll probably work in the hip, it'll probably work in the shoulder. And yet, you know, here we are sitting at 2015, and we still don't have FDA approval for the hip or the shoulder. And why? Because the companies really these days can't afford to push that particular rock uphill. So regrettably, I do think we will get some insurance coverage, let's say, for the big diseases like knee arthritis. You know, it's going to be a while before we get universal coverage of this kind of technology, just like it's been almost 20 years and we still don't have something as simple as a knee gel shot approved for the hip.
It's crazy. I mean, yeah. Who does it benefit? It doesn't benefit us, we the people,
to have
these things.
It doesn't. And you would think that, you know, there'd be some benefit to society of saying, okay, we know this stuff is really safe in that particular case. We know it's not hurting somebody. You know, we have a couple papers that seem to show it's good in other joints, so why not just make a multi-joint blanket statement that, yes, this is something to do. But I think the problem there is that we've created a regulatory infrastructure that's extraordinarily expensive. And again, many times we get access to things or not based on what that expense is.
Yeah. So let's talk about where people in the United States can have access to this. You're not the only one doing this anymore. But I don't know if there's anyone in Oregon or Washington.
Yeah, so there are some folks in Washington that we just recently trained.
Nice.
Let me see if I actually have. Might take me a second to make sure I don't misspeak here. And I don't know if they've yet announced that they're doing this, but let me just double check here.
But if they've been trained, they'll probably be doing it at some point.
Yeah, so the clinic is Columbia Pain Management in Hood River, Oregon.
Oh.
And
they came down and got trained by you guys.
They did. So they are now officially trained. We also have some folks in the L.A. area, Northern California, San Rafael, mm-hmm. that we've trained. That's HealthLink Medical Center in San Rafael. And then obviously we're in Colorado. And, you know, I think you'll find that there are folks out there that are offering to do this, and that's becoming more and more common. So I think that's great. We're seeing people have more access to it. You know, the downside with that is always just trying to make sure that they're very well trained and what they're doing makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that one can be a little harder sometimes to figure out. So there's a little bit of a wild, wild west situation going on, so you have to be a little careful.
Well, it's great to hear about Hood River. That's about a 3-hour drive from where we are. It's not bad, really.
Yeah.
If people want to get in touch with you, why don't you give whatever the best contact information?
Yeah, the best thing to do would be go to the Regenex website. That's www.regenexx.com with two X's. And
everything they need is there. It's a great website. Very
functional. Everything they need is there, and they can get all their questions answered, get in contact with us, get in contact with a local doctor, etc.
Great. Awesome. Well, my guest has been Dr. Chris Centeno. He does stem cell and other regenerative therapies from Colorado. Thanks again for talking to me.
Okay. Thank you so much, Anne.
Yeah,
thanks
I'm
for
excited.
Having me on.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.